WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
There's always so much you don't know about the people you listen to on the radio. I learned surprising things about NPR correspondent Jackie Lydon by reading her new memoir, Daughter of the Queen of Sheba. It's about growing up with a mother whose mental illness makes her unpredictable and unreliable, but in her own way mesmerizing and strong. The New York Times Review called the book one of the most indelible portraits of a mother-daughter relationship to come along in years. Just before Jackie was preparing for her very first radio broadcast on an FM station in Chicago, she got a call from her grandmother saying that Jackie's mother, Dolores, was dead. Jackie's grandmother had gotten a call from someone who said that Dolores had been in an accident and was smashed like hickory nuts on the highway. The hickory nuts image made Jackie suspicious. It was an image her mother would use because the girls used to enjoy smashing hickory nuts. Jackie suspected her mother made the call herself using a phony voice. Well, sure enough, the highway patrol had no report of this accident, so Jackie made her radio debut, reasonably confident her mother was still alive, but certain that her mother was missing.
I was very nervous going live that first night. It was a two-hour program, so it wasn't just like a short cameo appearance. And I remember thinking that as I'm sitting there talking about what seems like an absurdity, it was about the gold standard. This was back in the late 70s and unstable tribes in the Middle East and what all this portended, things I really knew nothing about, that my mother was out there somewhere. And I imagined, even though she was in Wisconsin and I was in Chicago, that maybe she could hear my voice and that maybe that's who I was talking to. You know, they tell young broadcasters, I'm sure you got this advice, pretend you're talking to that one special person out there. And I decided that that one special person would be my delusional, disappeared mom.
You write, Jackie, that your mother's fierce resistance to getting treated made it difficult to actually get a diagnosis for a long time. What were some of the difficulties you had in actually getting a diagnosis?
When mania of any type is left untreated, when any form of mental illness is left untreated, it becomes more severe. My mother's symptoms at the height of the illness would be hearing voices, seeing things that weren't there, personality that wasn't hers, free association, and in the very, very last stages, speech that was guttural, speech that you couldn't identify, intermixed with regular vocabulary. All those things, when a psychiatrist first encounters them, you know, when somebody is finally hauled into a psychiatric ward, look like schizophrenia. But that was not, in fact, what was wrong with my mother. She first became ill, not that ill, not nearly that ill, when I was about 12. So that it just wasn't easy for these rural doctors to figure out what was wrong with this woman. And I think also, Terry, that the mental health profession got more savvy. I don't know that manic depression used to be nearly as properly diagnosed as it is today.
When she was properly diagnosed and received medication, did it help her?
Potion from heaven. It was just like the sorcerer's green liquid, I think is what I call it, Terry. It's just, at least in my mother's case, it's fantastic.
You were 12 the first time she had, you know, a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
How did it look to you as a 12-year-old when you saw your mother becoming totally transformed into somebody else?
Well, what happened was that when I was 12, in the fall, which is around the time of my birthday, right around that time, I came home from school and found that my mother had vanished and that my stepfather had taken her off to the nut house, as my grandmother described it to me. And my grandmother was crying. My grandmother was a really dramatic, wonderful, wonderful woman. And I didn't see my mother, and my grandmother would drive my sisters and me past the hospital, and I say it was like watching for a character behind a harem scrim. I mean, we'd look up at the windows and think, she must be up there. And, you know, we'd see the patients walking around in the state of lassitude on the grounds, but we never saw her. Only learned later that what she was actually doing was being given what she called a lot of stupid craft projects.
When your mother returned after that first stay in the home for the mentally ill, she shocked you one day by becoming transformed into the Queen of Sheba. Would you tell us about that?
The most shocking transformation that I ever have seen in her delusions. I was 12 years old and home from school. My mom was home alone. She had only recently come back from the place that we called the Nut House, the Loony Bin, the good ship Lollapalooza. We had all kinds of names for it. And she was pretty frail that afternoon and depressed. And I thought, I'll go into my bedroom and cheer her up. And I was planning on making her a treasure hunt and reading this book about other cultures, the Aztec Indians, and dancing with headdresses. And there was a knock on the door, and I opened it, and it was my mother. And she had wrapped the bed sheets around herself and stuck this tiara that we'd played with as children on her head and drawn some pencil drawings on her shoulder. And she said, "I am the Queen of Sheba, and I bequeath to each of my daughters a country. To you, Jack, Mesopotamia, to your sisters, Kate and Sarah, Thebes and Carthage." And I said, "Mom, you know, what are you doing?" And she didn't answer me. She didn't seem to be seeing me. And she just sort of blew me a kiss and kind of moved from side to side and closed the door. And I did not follow her. I laid back down on the bed and just kind of went into a fetal position for a while. So shocked. I called my grandmother as soon as I got up, and I said, "You got to get over here." And I told her what had happened. And she said, "You just stay in your room." Well, first she said, "I don't believe you for a second." I said, "It's true. You have to come over here." And I didn't come out of the bed until my grandmother came. And by the time she came, my mother was apparently fine. And my grandmother and I never talked about this. She said, "I just don't want you to ever say a thing. You have a big imagination yourself, Jackie." And I thought, all right, maybe I really thought something up there. And yet that vision stayed with me. I never saw it again.
You said that you and your sisters tried tough love on your mother for a period. What was your version of tough love, and how well did it work?
Well, it sure as heck didn't work, because we really weren't able to be very tough. There was a Christmas where we were trying to get her in the hospital. She'd been sick for about 4 or 5 months, and we just had it up to our eyeballs. We were really worn out. And so we decided to boycott and not talk to her, because at that time she had started an imaginary business called Deja Vu Foods, and its motto, which she put on coffee cups, was "Think about me," which was so wonderful. But we'd sort of moved past the time of even being able to make jokes about it. And we thought, well, maybe we're too indulgent. Maybe that's why she won't go into the hospital. Let's try not seeing her. And I wrote her a letter and said, "I'm not going to see you. And unless you get treatment, and this is what you ought to do." And she wrote me back and said, "Listen, you creep, I'm returning every Mother's Day card you ever sent me." And did, you know, I got this whole box of cards, not only mine that I had sent her, but my sister's as well. It was just shocking. And then she very quickly followed it up with invitations to a Christmas fantasy that she was planning. And it was such a heartbreak, because every other day I'd get something to this Christmas fantasy party, you know, "Bring your own booze," and some of it would make sense and some of it wasn't, you know. And so we just hunkered in. My sister came down to Chicago, where I was living then, and my mother went ahead with her Christmas feast. We just stayed away. And I did call her on Christmas Day, and she went into this whole long delusional thing about, you know, the mafia being outside. And then she was hallucinating and saying, "All this forgiving, leave them laughing when you go." And I thought, what's the point of tough love? And my sister went home, and we had decided, all right, we're this is really heartbreaking, but we're not going to give in. And of course, she stopped at my mother's, and there was my mother, you know, alone at the table with this completely desiccated by now roast and these dried mashed potatoes and, you know, stiff little mounds of cranberry, completely alone. It was awful.
When your mother got well, you say that you missed her power. What exactly did you miss?
When my mother was well, she was a divorced woman who had no real career skills, who worked as a waitress, a hotel clerk, took packaging orders, I think, at one time, worked double shifts, worked in a weight loss clinic. This was someone who was spending her 40s drudging through the most wearying sorts of jobs, whereas before she had been a wealthy doctor's wife. And she was suffering, and when she was ill, she was none of those things, you know. I mean, she was always a vivacious, outgoing woman, sick or well. But when she was sick, she was so fantastic. And she gave my sisters and me just this parade of images and writings and costume and sense of drama and the sense, Terry, that you can be whoever you want to be. A phrase that my mother had spoken of a little bit differently when we were children. She would tell us much the same thing by sitting at her vanity and turning to us, and you have to remember my mother's a former model, and saying, "Always remember, girls, you are the most beautiful woman in the room." And then she'd turn back, and, you know, in her case, it was true. And we'd, "Oh, Mom," you know, sort of decorate her. So her fantasies had power.
It's interesting to me how you learn to be so capable, so competent. I mean, so good that, you know, NPR is ready to ship you off into war zones to cover a war. You really have to be very self-assured and resourceful, not to mention, you know, accurate in a situation like that. And I'm wondering if you think that you became that, you know, competent in spite of your mother, or if you needed to become that competent to compensate for your mother.
You know, it took a long, long time to put it all together until I wrote this book, I think. But I think that there is a huge correspondence between covering a war and living with someone who's mentally ill. The similarities are that you don't know what will happen. You don't know whom to trust. You don't know if what you just heard is true. You don't know where the threat is, but you know that there's a threat there and you would be foolish to ignore it, a physical threat, and that you feel comfortable with chaos. I have to say that it has taken me most of my adult life to sort of extricate myself with too much comfort with chaos. To look for conflict seemed a very natural thing for me. To be able to empathize with people, I think, is a good thing. To feel comfortable around violence is perhaps not such a good thing, frankly. There are other ways to live than to hear bullets whizzing past your head and that sort of thing. And yet I feel that I know how to look beyond the immediate aspects of a story. I'm not freaked out by things that are foreign or strange. In fact, I'm dearly attracted to them. And I think that's one of the great gifts of my mother's legacy.
You said that your mother doesn't really remember anything about her delusional period, but you've set a lot of that down in your memoir. Has your mother read it?
She has. She's looked at a lot of it, and there are things she agrees with and things she doesn't. One of the things I have is that my mother had what's called scribaciousness, which is, you know, a lot of this is directly from the scribaciousness means that you have compulsive handwriting. So a lot of this is directly from those times. And I think that she feels, even when something makes her uncomfortable, that it is a testament to all these years of trying to find out what was wrong and living this very hard life and being delusional and coming back. My mother's a survivor. She is a fantastic survivor. She's a funny, vivacious, outgoing woman.
Well, Jackie Lydon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Jackie Lydon's memoir is called Daughter of the Queen of Sheba. She's a senior correspondent at NPR and a substitute host for Weekend Edition and Weekend All Things Considered.